Hello and welcome to a very special edition of the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy. This time we're going to explore what is just in intonation and attribution with the help of our regular correspondent, University of Oxford Professor of Composition, Jennifer Walsh. Walsh is a champion and a former collaborator of the late American composer Tony Conrad, a pioneering artist who, along with Lamont Young, was one of the members of the Dream Syndicate, an experimental 1960s ensemble with a huge but complicated legacy in music, a legacy that for a long time saw Tony Conrad unable to control his own music. Walsh recorded an album with Conrad in what was the last year of his life in 2016. That collection of collaborations by the duo has now finally been released. In the Merry Month of May is the fruit of countless free improv encounters and features Walsh on vocals, singing her own texts, along with a pair on an arsenal of less familiar instruments. To celebrate this time, Jennifer Walsh introduces us to the sounds and the enduring ideas of Tony Conrad.
Because everybody is so used to hearing Steve Reich and Philip Glass, you know, and those tracks, like I remember reading an interview with Philip Glass in NME back in the 90s, and it said he was the highest paid composer in the world. So that's sort of what I would call like really crisp, clean, rhythmic minimalism. That's become what we think of when we talk about minimalism. But I'm really interested in, you know, what Tony was doing, because there's something even rawer. You know, it's going back even further. It's saying, okay, let's strip even more away until we're just there with raw sound. And I think that's something really special. Tony was born in 1940, so he's in New York in the 60s, you know, and he's like a young guy in his 20s. I knew him when he was in his late 60s and early 70s. So when I'm talking about Tony in his 20s, I'm also sort of thinking back through time of how I knew him and the stories that he would tell me about that time. So he was sort of in this very creative world. And legend has it that he had a book called The Velvet Underground, and Lou Reed saw that, and that's how the name of The Velvet Underground came to be.
And actually, if you listen to Tony Conrad's own music and you're familiar with The Velvet Underground, you do hear a lot of the same seeds, maybe.
Oh, definitely. I mean, when I hear The Velvet Underground and I hear John Cale's viola drones, I think of Tony. Okay, so I would have listened to The Velvet Underground before I listened to The Dream Syndicate, or what's also known as the Theatre of Eternal Music, this group that consisted of Lamont Young, Marion Zazila, John Cale, and Tony Conrad doing these long-form drones together. He had studied maths, and so when he started playing with Lamont Young and John Cale and Marion Zazila, Tony was very interested in just intonation tuning. For anyone who's unfamiliar with the term, just intonation tuning is actually the natural way that notes are tuned. So if you play up an empty pipe, you play up these different harmonics, whereas when you play the piano, everything's been tuned to sort of fit into what we call equal temperament, 12 chromatic notes per octave. That was something he brought to the group. And Lamont Young, who's still alive, minimalist composer, Lamont Young was also interested in these sort of just intonation relationships. And so when they were improvising with the group that came to be known as either the Dream Syndicate or the Theatre of Eternal Music, they were using these just intonation intervals to drone for very long periods of time, because if you really tune things properly like that, you get all these beautiful harmonics and overtones above. So when I hear The Velvet Underground and I hear the drones, and even when I hear Nico, those amazing, amazing albums that John Cale did with Nico, I hear that influence of these drones and these pure number relationships. And so certainly when I hear this recording, Inside the Dream Syndicate, Volume 1, Day of Niagara, you get this sense of what they were doing together as people, you know, and you can sort of hear what was happening, and you can even hear these drones that you're going to hear in The Velvet Underground, that you're going to hear in Nico's solo albums that she did with John Cale, that you're going to hear in Tony's music. So you can see this was sort of a common concern. This recording is supposed to have been recorded on the 25th of April, 1965. And then it was released by Table of the Elements, who's a fantastic label that actually released a lot of Tony's music later on down the line.
This was all happening in the context of a kind of a really vibrant new music scene in Manhattan at the time. But it sort of turned out rather unhappily because obviously Lamont Young and Tony Conrad had an awful lot in common, and John Cale as well, with how they felt about music. But that turned out to be a problem.
It really is heartbreaking in that you had a scene where you had people, and at the time they were in their 20s, you know, they're young people and they're improvising together, and the different people involved in those sessions consider it improvisation. John Cale has said he considered it improvisation, a group improvisation, something that they created together. So has Tony. Tony said it many, many times. But ultimately, the person who pressed record on the tape recorder and who had the tape recorder was Lamont Young. And so Lamont Young, at a certain point, said he refused to release any of these recordings unless everybody signed a document saying that they were actually compositions by Lamont Young as opposed to group improvisations. And Tony talked a lot about this time in his life as a time where he really felt he wanted to get rid of composition. That's the phrase he used to use, that he felt like composers were outdated, and it was about what Christopher Small would call musicking. It was about people together making music. And you sort of have this beautiful vision of group improvisation, and then that comes crashing down when Lamont Young says, well, retrospectively, I'm calling these my compositions, and I'm not going to let you have access to the tapes. Violins fits in chronologically, but it's also proof that this sort of sound world that the Dream Syndicate were playing in, that Tony was also doing it independently, because Four Violins, the legend has it, is a recording that Tony made by himself in 1964, trying these different drones out. To me, it sounds exactly like Tony, this very overdriven sound on the violins. But it didn't surface until the 90s. It was proof that this world of just intonation and drone, that this was something that Tony was doing independently. So it's sort of an artistic vindication. You know, fantastic drone music, really overdriven like rock music is. You know, like a rock music guitar would be full of all these different tones and harmonics from this gorgeous just intonation tuning, this world that you can just melt into. And I didn't know immediately, this is also this sort of vindication of this decades-long, you know, argument between the members of the Dream Syndicate and Lamont Young as to who had a stake in this music. When I knew Tony, I knew him, how could I phrase this? So I got to know Tony in the sort of late in the first decade of the 21st century. By the time I got to know him, I had known of him for quite some time. And I think that part of the reason for that was that I did my master's and I did my doctorate in composition in Chicago at Northwestern University. And Gastro del Sol, David Grubbs and Jim O'Rourke, who, you know, later went on to join Sonic Youth, their band, they collaborated with Tony, and they were sort of younger guys who were interested in his work. So I heard about Tony when I was living in Chicago, and I heard of him, you know, people spoke about him as a musician. They spoke about him, about Four Violins, about the early minimalism box set. People were really excited about that. And because Chicago had a really fantastic, still does have a really fantastic free improvisation scene, I had heard of Tony, first of all, in that context, as a free improviser, as a musician. And it wasn't until I actually got to know Tony that I actually got to know more about his film work and his TV work and all of these projects that he's done. Here was somebody who really was doing truly interdisciplinary avant-garde work, working across every single discipline. Tony lived in New York, did a degree in mathematics, had always played music, had learned to play Bach on his violin and things like that prior to getting to New York, did all these drones, but then started making films. And some films, really out there films like The Flicker, which just consists of, you know, black and white frames alternating in these patterns, which are designed so that your brain will start to hallucinate colors. It's like really out there avant-garde film. He at one point did a homework helpline on public access television where kids could phone in and ask for help with their maths problems. So when I knew Tony, I sort of got to know this entire history about film and art that he had been engaged in, because I'd only really known about the music part of his life because I was a musician and I came to his work as a musician primarily. And that really left a lasting impact on me because he just pursued the ideas that he thought were really interesting and really important to pursue. And whatever medium those ideas were in, he just hit that medium and went with it. I found that deeply, deeply inspiring.
The amazing thing is, as we were saying, there were all these problems with the music they'd been making in the 60s in New York, and people weren't hearing it. So it was actually much later on and outside of New York when Tony Conrad got to record Outside the Dream Syndicate, which is officially his first LP.
I think it's really interesting that this is a recording made with like a German prog rock band. You know, like it's in a very different context, and It sounds very, very different because you have this steady drum beat behind the violins. You know, it's not multi-tracked. It's much more about like a band playing with Tony. And it sounds fantastic, but it has a different life. It functions in a different way. And I think it's very interesting for that reason. And it was also a way that, you know, really what we call like avant-garde new music, experimental music, met more with popular music. You know, meant more, started to edge towards what we would think of when we talk about pop.
Well, which is funny in a way, because we have been talking about how close what they were doing in the real avant-garde period in the mid-60s was to pop music of the time, like to the Velvet Underground. There was always this kind of parallel track.
Well, definitely. And I know that sort of Tony used to talk about the fact that when they would get together and they would play together in the Dream Syndicate, that they were really interested in these just intonation relationships. They also had a gong that I believe Robert Morris made for them. And Stockhausen came to visit New York, and Stockhausen came to visit the Dream Syndicate and then went away and wrote Stimmung, which is, you know, a vocal piece which uses drones and a lot of just intonation. And he wrote Microphony, which is a piece where you amplify a gong in different ways. And I know that certainly, like, Tony felt that Stockhausen completely ripped them off, you know, just came and plucked these two major ideas from what they were doing and went back to, you know, the German new music scene and wrote it all down, because they weren't writing anything down and it was a different sort of scene. So I feel very much you have this blurry Venn diagram where, and the other thing I should mention is, like, you know, Lamont Young in the early 60s is living with Yoko Ono at a certain point, and they're putting on these series of events in the loft, sort of Fluxus art performances. So you've got like Yoko Ono, who will go on to sort of, you know, marry John Lennon, but Yoko Ono is coming from this Fluxus experimental art scene, interested in John Cage, married to Toshi Ichinagi at one point, you know, but really interested in hardcore new music. And then Lamont Young, you know, and her meet, they put on these Fluxus events, and then Tony is doing drone music and nobody's quite sure, what is this? Is this Fluxus? Is it free improvisation? Is it new music? Stockhausen's pretty clear, oh no, I'm going to make it into new music by sort of taking these elements and spinning them into Stimmung and other pieces. So that's what I think is very interesting, is it's not clear. There aren't clear lines between things. With Outside the Dream Syndicate, of course it's staking space. The reference to the Dream Syndicate is really important. But it's also sort of moving towards a rock scene, because you're playing with Faust, you're playing with like prog legends.
Most attractive to me about working with Jenny is that we can dip into these deep wells of expertise and prior practice in a way that's inventive and flexible, and it's just really fun to do.
And that brings us to the merry month of May, maybe. Tell us a little bit about the history of your own work with him. Seeing he died in 2016.
He did indeed.
And the album you recorded with him was recorded that year. So maybe what happened to it since then? I guess Lamont Young wasn't messing that one up.
No, Tony and I first became friends because we were playing a festival in Meaford, Ontario, at a place called the Funny Farm. And we hit it off and we discovered that we both lived in the same part of Brooklyn. And so gradually we started to hang out and play. Even from the first time I played with Tony, he didn't even bring his violin. He brought a Hawaiian steel guitar, like a slide guitar that he had just purchased off the internet. I thought, this is really interesting, because he's just thinking, what's the next thing? He's not sitting on his laurels. He's not thinking, well, I'm already sort of a legend of the avant-garde, you know, amuse me. He's just excited about what's around the corner. So we started playing together, and from the very first time we played, Tony wanted to record everything. Every single thing that we did was recorded. But what was also really important to him was that both of us had copies of everything, so that neither of us were the only one person. And it went both ways. Like, he made sure always we would have regular sort of check-ins where we'd look at all the files and how we'd labeled them. And he also was adamant that I could do whatever I wanted with the recordings independently of him, and he could do whatever he wanted with the recordings independently of me. And when he first sort of talked about that, I just sort of thought, you know, why is he saying this? And then I realized, yeah, this is about what happened with the Dream Syndicate. And so we made all these recordings, and we just loved playing together, and we played together as much as we could. A lot of our early work was just us getting together in a room, in all sorts of different strange rooms. We improvised in my apartment in New York. We improvised in his apartment. He had these different sort of artist studios all over the place, almost like sort of CIA safe houses or something. You know, just these sort of, he'd say, oh, I have a room in this place, and it's just full of doors with glass windows in them. You know, let's go in and improvise there. So we just tried to play as much as we possibly could. Bye. So, for example, the title track, when Tony started, I just thought, I want to take these drones. I just had this flash in my mind where I was like, take the drones and do something different with them. And I had this image of Luke Kelly and Luke Kelly's highly nasal vocal timbre. I think Luke Kelly's amazing. And so I thought, I'm just going to go into that. And I started just singing the opening lines of The Rocky Road to Dublin, extremely slowed down. And that became how I found my way into that improvisation. So it's sort of different routes into different tracks.
In the merry morn, in the
The combination of the two of you together has brought this kind of amazing content, like the texts become as rich as the sound, which is not something that is all the way through his music. Like, it's something that seems to arrive with that collaboration.
When I worked with Tony first, it was at a point where I didn't really use text very much in an improv setting, because it was rare that people used text in a free improvisation setting. And I was also aware that some musicians really don't like it if you use text in free improv context. Now, that could be text in a free improv context where you're using your voice, or it could be that you're dropping a sample with speech in it. And on one level, I can understand why some people feel like that, because cognitively, when you're listening to music, your brain will prioritize whatever information is coming out of a human mouth over the other information. And that's just how we're built. That's how we can go into a busy restaurant and understand that they don't have a table, even though there's music and people talking. And so it does create this sort of asymmetry in free improv forces, because if you've got like five musicians on the stage and everybody's making a texture and then the singer starts telling a story, everybody will sort of downgrade their attentional focus on the instruments and upgrade, you know, whatever's coming out of the singer's mouth. For a long time, I had used my voice as a free improviser, but I'd never really used text very much for that reason. And I mean, I think, to be quite honest, it was never a conscious decision. It was sort of an instinctual thing. And then when I started working with Tony, I started using loads of text. And he really was encouraging. He had no problem with it. He thought it added a great extra layer. That really was the beginning for me of a big shift in my practice of using text. And he, you know, he didn't care what sort of text I used. He, you know, of course, we would talk about it and say when things worked or when things didn't, in the same way that we talk about the instruments we were using and when things worked or they didn't. But that sort of changed my life in many ways, in that I started using text more and more. And I started, ever since I was a child, I had kept notebooks of text where I'd collected scraps of text and written scraps of text. And now I started bringing these to free improv sessions in the same way that Tony and I would bring like a bin bag full of instruments, you know, and objects and, you know, things we might get a sound out of. He really did believe, you know, if we're going to say free improvisation is free, anything should be permitted. Mm. Tony and I both wanted everything to be permitted. You could have a moment where there could be dancing or a sea shanty. Because I remember that happening in one of our sets. And both of us dancing a really terrible hornpipe for a while.
Day of the Fair comes kind of close to that as well.
I think Day of the Fair, in a way, is emblematic because it's like a weapons-grade earworm that I sort of feel I need to apologise to people for in advance.
2x2x3x4 on the day of the fair. On the day of the fair.
One of the first conversations I had with Tony was about traditional Irish music. He wanted to talk about harmonic structures and implied harmonic structures. But what we were both interested in a way, with this album also, and I suppose it was something that we were just interested in without ever having to sort of decide this is the concept of the album, but just this constant regeneration of what folk is, that folk music should be by people and we should be free to like talk about the concerns, use the language of the time that we're living in, rather than feeling it's something that should be kept in a glass cabinet display case.
Everything will be fine, I think. Everything, I think that everything...
In a museum.
I think that everything will be fine. I mean, we all joke, fun, you know, but...
With Wake Up, I had a text that I jotted down about, you know, when I was a kid, thinking that my father was dead when he stopped snoring, because my father snores really loudly. So if he stopped snoring, you think, what's going on? You know, and I said this, I think my father woke up with me standing over him at one point. I gave him a terrible fright. And then he told me that when I was little, he used to think I was dead and he'd put a mirror in front of my face to see if I was still breathing. So I had sort of jotted down these different texts. And then, you know, when we're improvising, I sort of am beginning to riff on them, and I'm beginning to see this story or this image, you know, form in my mind. And then my job is to try to describe that.
Everything will be okay, I think, you know. And then it's every morning, like up, down, top, bottom.
So it's a very bent, weird folk, you know, overdriven folk, which involves, you know, we had to buy a canvas picture frame, and then Tony used a knife to cut some of the canvas away and then put a contact mic on it so that he could bow the ripped bit of canvas, and it made this huge big sub bass sound. So that's our folk, you know, our tins of Goya string beans that we poured out and mulched between our hands and had recorded, along with these stories that we're telling, which are very old stories, like the idea of being worried somebody's dead. That's an infinitely ancient story, you know, that anybody from any point in history could relate to.
Check that the breathing's still happening, and at times just checking that, you know, it's still moving, and get on with your day and have your lunch at your desk, have a desk lunch, and we all like to joke, we all like to fun, but it's not joke, fun anymore, it's not joke, you know, we all fun, joke, laugh, like fun, joke, laugh, like everything will be fine, I think, everything will be fine, I think, I hope, I think.
When Tony died, it was terrible. For so many people. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm one of the many, many friends he had, one of the many, many people who loved him very much. And, you know, and so it felt like it was a big responsibility. This is like the last album, you know, he will have made. And for him and me, it was a record of, you know, a long period of collaboration, but also a period of collaboration late in his life. So I didn't want to try and rush it out. You know, I wanted to really just sort of make it feel okay for me. And so I waited a couple of years, and we were moving towards releasing it, and then the pandemic hit. Then you think, let's not rush anything out, because you don't want it to get lost in the mix. So I'm really, really delighted that it's out now. And I also feel I have enough distance from it that I'm very happy that it's out, but I don't feel it so close that if somebody didn't like it, I'd feel really furious, you know, because Tony had just passed. I think for me, you know, it would have been lovely to get it out earlier, but it's also, I think, the right time now. And one thing I've been tremendously moved by is there's a lot of people who really love him and really loved his music and still really love his music that were delighted to get a new release.
We all like to joke, fun.
That makes me really happy, because it's not just about me. It's not just about me receiving the album. It's me thinking, okay, this is really lovely, you know, that people are excited to hear more of Tony.
It's like gothic romance. It's like a pleasing sort of terror. It's something that we enjoy being afraid of.
Jennifer Walsh there on the sound world of the late composer Tony Conrad. And Tony Conrad, Jennifer Walsh, in The Merry Month of May, is out now.